I think we've done a lot of damage with the generational rhetoric. And that's one place that we can start, as you said, to recognize people of different ages, people of different stages are not monolithic groups. You can't just put a label on someone and say, well, because we define them as a boomer or as a millennial, that it means anything about them that's meaningful. It doesn't. Each person is a unique individual.
Welcome to Coming of Age, a podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. I'm your host, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. In season 3 of Coming of Age, we're tackling big issues with our remarkable guests, leaders from around the world who are transforming seniors' care and shaping the future for all of us as we age. Subscribe now to Coming of Age and join our community dedicated to meeting the needs of our aging population. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Point Click Care is a leading healthcare technology platform enabling meaningful collaboration and access to real-time insights at any stage of a patient's healthcare journey. Point Click Care's single platform spans the care continuum, fostering proactive, holistic decision-making and improved outcomes for all. Over 25,000 long-term post-acute care providers and more than 1,600 hospitals use Point Click Care today. For more information on Point Click Care's software solutions, visit pointclickcare.com. Welcome back to a new episode of Coming of Age. We are delighted to continue our deep dive into the issues and opportunities for seniors care in Ontario, Canada, and around the world. Today, we'll be discussing a topic that's at the heart of many issues for all of us, ageism. I'm sitting down with Tracy Gendron, the chair of the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Gerontology and director for the Virginia Center on Aging. Tracy is also an activist and author. Tracy's 2022 book, Ageism Unmasked, Exploring Age Bias and How to End It, challenges each of us in how we think about and approach aging. Based in Virginia in the United States, Tracy Gendron holds a master's degree in gerontology, a master's degree in psychology, and a PhD in developmental psychology. Her research explores the roots of ageism and fosters hope along the way for how to end it for good. Let's dive in. I have just finished reading your book, Tracy, Ageism Unmasked, Exploring Age Bias and How to End It. And I have to tell you, you've got a great ear. Highly recommend this book. It is a beautiful read. There's a musicality to the way that Tracy writes, and it's a heavy topic, but Tracy, you make it really, really accessible. In your book, you actually define aging, what it is and what it isn't. And I think that's a great place to start today.
Yeah, I agree. And first of all, thank you for having me here. Thank you for the kind words about the book. I'm so glad that you liked it. It is a fascinating topic, one that is very rich and very nuanced and applicable because we're all aging. So you're right that I think the way to start talking about ageism is to first talk about aging and what is aging. And I think that we misunderstand aging in a couple of different ways. I think we often talk about aging as if it's something that is happening to other people, like when we talk about the aging population. And I did that myself many times for many years until I had a moment when I realized, why do I talk about older people as the aging population, whereas we are all aging every day? It's something that's about us. So I think when we other it, we don't connect with the fact that aging is a universal that we all share. And then I think we tend to talk about aging really is a process of decline in terms of our physical bodies and how our bodies change. There's reasons for that. I think it's something we can relate to. I think it's actually really part of the experience that our bodies just get aches and pains and can't do the things that they used to do. But that's just one part of aging. Aging is the biopsychosocial spiritual process of change, growth over time. So it means that while we have declined, we're also growing and evolving and developing in so many ways. And that's the story less told. That's the part that we don't talk about as much as all of the ways that we like ourselves more, that we continue to grow and evolve, that we continue to become. So I think we need to see aging as holistic for what it really is.
You also talk about elderhood. So instead of talking about aging, you recommend that we reframe the discussion on aging. Could you speak to that?
Absolutely. So it's interesting that we're all really familiar with developmental stages of life. We talk really readily and easily about infancy and toddlerhood and childhood and adolescence. And then we even have this stage called emerging adulthood, where we recognize that once you turn a certain age, you don't necessarily become an adult. There's a transitionary period. And then we talk about adulthood, and then we just keep talking about adulthood, and then maybe older adulthood. And I think that there's power in having a term and a word to recognize that we develop in later life in distinct and unique ways that are different from adulthood. And I think elderhood is the term that really captures that. And just like adulthood, there's no one age in which you become an elder or go into elderhood. There's transitional periods. It's different for everybody. But the power is that I think roles and opportunities are different for us in elderhood than they are in adulthood. Adulthood is like a lot of busyness. We're developing our careers. We're raising children. We're then leading up to the culmination of our career. And then we just talk about retiring. Retiring means what we used to do. It's a withdrawal. Whereas elderhood is about who we are continuing to become. And I think there's a lot of power in that.
When we were chatting in preparation for today's podcast, you actually made a really great point about the game of life and how to win the game of life.
Yep, we win the game of life by reaching retirement. And then what? And the person with the most money wins. And that's not really the game of life.
Really isn't. We really have stigmatized aging. I'm wondering, how do we tackle this? How do we take the steps to address ageism and change the culture around growing older?
I think culture change is big. And I think it can be scary when we're having these conversations and feeling, well, what can I do? And yet, I really think all of the power of culture change is about little individual things that we do. So I think that we collectively have the power to reframe how we think about aging, how we talk about aging, how we role model aging, like recognizing that what we say and how we talk about our own experiences and our own age is role modeling for everybody else. And there's a lot of power in that. So first we want to see it. First we need to recognize, okay, we live in a pretty ageist world that doesn't understand holistic aging. And then we start to get the tools that we need to say, how do I talk about this? How do I think about this? How do I put this out into the world? And then we can learn more and start to challenge ourselves to think differently and act differently. And I really think policy change comes on the heels of culture change, which is about the little things we do every day. So I think the power is with everyday people to think about this differently.
So it's celebrate incrementalism one person at a time. We're not a monolithic group. No generation is monolithic. And yet we consistently and continually pit one generation after another generation. As you point out in your book, none of us is independent. We are all interdependent.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, how do I shift that thinking?
I think we've done a lot of damage with the generational rhetoric. And that's one place that we can start, as you said, to recognize people of different ages, people of different stages are not monolithic groups. You can't just put a label on someone and say, well, because we define them as a boomer or as a millennial, that it means anything about them that's meaningful. It doesn't. Each person is a unique individual. And when you get away from using age as a guide for something, because it's meaningless, age doesn't tell you anything about anyone other than how long they've been on the planet. It doesn't tell you what they value. It doesn't tell you what their ideology is. It doesn't tell you about their abilities, nothing. So we need to get past kind of those labels and using that as a guidepost, and then recognize the value of all people. I think part of that argument that younger people use is because we don't have a sense of elderhood, because we see older people as the one who's old and just takes rather than one who contributes. And part of that is because we haven't defined meaningful roles for older people. And yet there's so many opportunities for older people, elders, to be, you know, people that give wisdom, that really use all of their life experiences to help navigate complex situations. There's just so many gifts of elderhood, but we don't see it, so we don't see the value. So I think the key is we need to stop using age as a marker of anything meaningful and start to see each person as an individual.
And that starts with us as individuals.
Yeah, certainly does.
How much of it do you think is fear?
Oh, I think a lot of it is fear. And I think it's fear of a lot of things. I think it's fear of being judged by others, fear of being devalued, fear of death. That certainly plays a role in it. In the book, I talk about a moment that I was in a grocery store and I saw one of those tabloids that said Betty White giving up on life at 96 or whatever it was at the time. And it was such a moment of thinking, we see death as a failure instead of like the end of life's journey. So there's so much that underlies this fear that we carry around with us. Yeah.
Well, and the reality is that each and every one of us will ultimately die.
Absolutely.
Our lives will end.
Yep.
And what matters is what we've done with it. And to be able to find purpose at whatever juncture we're at really is so key, as you've noted in your book.
Absolutely.
For the benefit of our listeners, again, I really encourage you to read Tracy's book. The examples that you use to bring it to life, talking about your grandfather and your parents and their journey and how they reacted as their lives changed and they grew older and that sense of purpose being lost.
Yes. And that is so key. I will say vacations are wonderful, but they're wonderful because they end. So this idea of retirement as a permanent vacation doesn't suit a lot of people. We need a reason to get up in the morning. We need purpose. We need to know that we matter. We need to know that this is what I'm doing today and that I'm contributing. In whatever way that is, that's really key to our happiness.
I'm really quite amazed right now. So all of us, every country, I think, is facing a global workforce challenge. Every country's trying to navigate the same issue. I know New York State has introduced a program called a Silver Corps, where they are trying to support 55 plus. I don't consider that to be especially old, but people who'd left the workforce to come back. And I'm wondering, have you, in your research, do you feel that there are any countries who have figured out how to reflect or support the realities of aging as it really is, not what people perceive it to be?
I think at this point, ageism itself is everywhere. And the research shows that it really exists in just about every continent, every country. But I will say, I feel like there are some cultures that really recognize the value of elders in a different kind of way and have customs and rituals embedded within the culture that acknowledge and recognize elders and see elderhood as a time of reverence and a time that can be celebrated. There are a few Asian cultures that have very specific days of reverence for older people. There are a few Asian cultures that have celebrations at 60 and then every 12 years or so after as a milestone. That's something that we don't really have here in the States or in Canada, is to say, wow, you've reached 72, you've reached 84, whatever it is. This is a milestone in your development. And those kind of cultures, they do recognize that aging is again, that contradictory growth and decline at the same time and acknowledge and even celebrate that. So there are some kind of examples within customs, but overall, as societies move towards more capitalism, they tend to value productivity, efficiency. As families disperse and we have fewer and fewer intergenerational families, ageism rise.
There really continues to be enormous stigma. Mm-hmm. How do we create a movement against this? Create a movement in support that celebrates our aging journey. And to your point, it is aging just isn't about much older, frail people. It's a different journey for each and every one of us, but each of us is aging. How do we change that?
I think we have to start asking why first. I think sometimes we're just so used to something being normal. Think about why do we segregate older people and people with disabilities? The bigger why of that. Now, I understand people with very complex needs. It's very challenging for them to remain in a home environment where they can't have care. But who else do we really segregate that way other than old people and people with disabilities? We really don't segregate other people. So why are we doing that? Why are we focused on these more institutional type of solutions rather than investing in home-based and community-based solutions? And I think if we just start by asking ourselves why, we can go, maybe because it's just that's how it's been and I haven't really thought about it. Why do we have a critical shortage of people that want to work with older folks? Well, because we have really demoralized what it means to be older, in part because we've institutionalized people and we made it scary and we made it something that's behind those walls. So people don't want to go into those careers. Why don't we mandate in all of the health professions that there's geriatric training? Why? We don't. We invest in pediatric training, but there's very little mandates for geriatric training when the vast majority of people will end up working with older people. So why is healthcare set up the way that it is to really value efficiency rather than relationships? And I get these are very complex problems. I do get it. But I think once we ask ourselves why, then maybe we can start to think about, well, what would the solutions be? What would this look like if we did it differently and invest in it differently? And I think truly that's a good enough starting place as any.
I think that's a great point around curriculum and education and training. We're facing a shortage of primary care providers in Ontario and Canada. And what we keep hearing anecdotally is that our family physicians are burnt out. They're carrying heavy caseloads in large part because of an older patient population with very complex needs. The younger med school students are more attracted to the super specialties to be able to study a whole person and to look at them in biopsychosocial frame is, I would think, would be far more rewarding.
Absolutely. But people, as you said, they don't think about it that way. And at least here in the States, it's not rewarded either. Geriatricians are some of the lowest paid specialty areas in medicine. So we also don't value it in terms of how the system is built.
We really do need to come back and challenge our assumptions. So many of them go unspoken and we just accept things. And yet, individually and collectively, we really do have the power to change things by not accepting the status quo.
Exactly. By asking the questions and then by starting with ourselves and how we feel about our own aging and how we feel about our own age. Really, it starts with self. And that's how we build up critical mass.
I do like that idea. And to become more self-aware as I was reading your book, thinking about my own aging journey, and my peers from childhood, each one of us is aged differently.
Yep.
One of the things that we keep thinking about in our organization is how can we engage younger people and get them excited to come into elder care? And what are those opportunities to harness the power of high school students or younger children and bring them intergenerational programming? How do we bring in people who are just beginning their lives and have an opportunity to learn the value of working with older people? There's a program in the city of Toronto for their long-term care, seniors care. I think I'm with you. We've got to find a better way of talking about it. But it's a volunteer program for high school students, which I think is a great idea for bringing high school students in to work and support and engage with seniors. I think it's a great opportunity. We know that people who have been exposed at a young age and have been taught to value seniors will come back and work with them.
Yes, absolutely. One of the very best things we can do to disrupt ageism is to have older people and younger people develop relationships with each other. Really, it's like the very best thing that we can do is just have people of all ages share space together and learn about what they have in common and learn about how they can support each other. I think one of the mistakes that we often make when we do intergenerational programming is that it's a one-way relationship, like younger people serving older people. It doesn't give then older people to have the opportunity to be mentors or to develop relationships, to learn from younger people as younger people are learning from older people. There needs to be that cross value. But when you put people of different ages in a room and you let them explore the things that they have in common with each other, the affinities that they have, maybe it's gardening, maybe it's reading, maybe it's painting, and let them come together around that, then they start to really get to know each other and it breaks down some of those age barriers. So I think it's key. And what we find is people that come to us in gerontology have either had really positive early role models or have had a personal experience with a loved one when they say, this is system, it's not right, and I want to fix this. There's multiple paths to wanting to work with older people, but those early relationships, as you said, are so critical.
Well, and that does speak to your point that you make so well around interdependence. And how do you foster the right kind of interdependence? No one's fully independent. And using the language about being independent, it's a false narrative because it's not true.
Absolutely. We are always dependent on each other, always at every stage of life. We have this myth of independence where we stigmatize what it means to be dependent and talk about fear, back to that conversation, fearing being a burden to others, fearing I'm not going to be able to take care of myself. That really adds and underlies negative feelings about aging, where the truth is we may have disabilities throughout our lives at multiple times in our lives. For some people, their entire life. There's nothing wrong with needing help. We have trouble asking for it, but there's nothing wrong with needing it and thinking differently about what it means to be independent and autonomous, and how we always rely on each other. And that's a good thing. That's part of being human.
We were speaking with an organization, a Rotary Club in Ontario, in a smaller rural community, where somebody approached us because they have a lot of retirees in their community who want to give back. And they don't want to give back by perhaps just going to work at a McDonald's or volunteering in their church. They actually want to use the skills that they developed in their careers.
Imagine that.
They want purpose.
Yes.
They want purpose and they want to be able to help someone. And so it did come up in our discussion when we were sharing just some of the challenges that people working in seniors care face in long-term care. There are so many people who do want to help. And again, that's their sense of purpose, their why. They don't want to be on vacation anymore.
Exactly.
They actually want to do things.
Exactly. And want to give back and want to use their skills and want to make the world better.
Do you see in your work any difference between how ageism affects women versus how ageism affects men?
I do. And it is different. It definitely exists for both, but I think there's different stressors and there's different tension points. I think for women, we're also talking about the intersection of sexism and ageism. So let's just take the workplace, for example. women have always gotten paid less historically. They have always experienced kind of cumulative risk of being discriminated against because they are female. And then you add age on top of it, and it becomes like a cumulative disadvantage. So it's harder to get a job. It's harder to get promoted. Women often feel as if they are invisible, as if their voices are not heard, especially older women who feel dismissed. And yet there's the other side of that where so much attention is paid to women's appearance that women can also feel hypervisible. So has she had work done? What does her skin look like? Does she have wrinkles? Has she dyed her hair? Is she keeping up with her appearance? Is she fit? There's so much shame that goes on that tells women how they need to look, what the definition or standard of beauty is, and how we should measure up to that. I think those are some particularly sensitive issues that are directed specifically at women. For men, I think it can look a little bit different. When you think about the top product that is marketed to older men, it tends to be around erectile dysfunction and low testosterone. And so there's a message there about what it means to be successful as an older man. So it's focused on virility and it's focused on potency and really doesn't think of men as caregivers and what it's like, which there's a lot of positives and a lot of men report a lot of joy about being a caregiver, but we don't talk about that as being a masculine trait. We talk about nurturing and caregiving as being more feminine. So there's a different kind of shame. And I think for many older men, ageism, maybe older white men, one of the first forms of discrimination that they experience. And that can be super interesting when you've spent a lifetime in a more privileged group and then suddenly you're experiencing people looking at you differently, treating you differently. So I think, again, it's just qualitatively different for both, but I think the effects of ageism affect both.
There is a lot in that. I have to say, I think we think a lot about the stereotypes of older women, especially through literature, through film, through think back to the Brothers Grimm and the fairy tales. It's always these decrepit little old ladies who are so evil and witches and
hags.
And whereas you don't necessarily see that same representation for older men.
Now, even in Hollywood, you see the older men with younger women. That's a trope, but it's out there. But you don't see as much representation of older women.
But things are changing, to your point. I think there are glimmers of hope for progress, your book being one of them.
Yeah.
Could you share what you're experiencing? I don't know if you're starting to see an uptake in the number of individuals who are wanting to pursue a career in gerontology, more books being written, more demand for you and your time. What does hope look like in this space?
Yeah, there's so much hope. There's so much good news, and it really excites me. I've been a gerontologist for almost 30 years now, and nobody knew what that was 30 years ago. Nonetheless, what a career being a gerontologist was. And we've made a lot of progress in that time. And even in the past 10, 15 years, when I really started to understand the need to get deeper into ageism, we have seen things change for the better a lot. There is more awareness of this than there ever has been before. There are more people that are out there advocating for this. There are more people writing books. There are more people that are speaking about it. There's more efforts being made to include it, ageism and ableism, in diversity initiatives. We're really starting to see the fruits of the labor of all the people that have been out there saying, hey, let's pay attention to this, come to fruition. The pandemic, in many ways, was good for it because it made ageism more visible. And for that, I am grateful. You started to see more articles being written about it. You started to see people questioning why care homes were hit so hard and what that meant and the value of older people. So there's a lot of good news. We're definitely seeing more students come to gerontology than we ever have before who want to have a career working with older people. We are definitely starting to see this word ageism infiltrate into more mainstream consciousness. That's amazing. So there is so much to celebrate. And I think there's a lot of momentum. And I just see this continuing to build.
That's so encouraging. I used to work in the mental health sector and ran a large children's mental health organization that was one of the largest teaching sites in Canada for professionals in that space. And I used to always ask the students and the residents who came in for their education and training, why are you in mental health? And would you come and work in children's mental health? Or is this just a mandatory rotation for you? And I really noticed a shift in that world. And I find it so fascinating that through the pandemic, two of the things I care very deeply about, addressing ageism and supporting our older adults who are frail, and mental health really coming to the fore. And it was a terrible tragedy what we endured. And again, to see some of the good things come out of that, including having a bigger discussion around elderhood, aging, ageism, and start to actually recognize that we individually and collectively have a duty of care to one another, regardless of our age.
Absolutely.
We really did make older people invisible. And the tragedy of the pandemic was that it shone a light on those who had not been seen and forced us to see them. And I think as well, start to confront what our own wishes and desires are.
And sometimes it takes a catalyst like that, as you said, as tragic as it is and was, that is something that I'm glad we are now having conversations about, because it was truly invisible before. And at least you started to see people reporting on it, questioning it, asking those types of questions that we didn't the year before, to talk about the value of older people, to talk about, yes, older people are just as important as the economy, and prioritizing what we have to do here to keep people safe and keep the economy running. We weren't having these conversations. So it did open the door.
I do think that we are seeing here, we're having different conversations. We have a senior summit, which is a group of organizations from across the healthcare, home and community care, hospitals, mental health, where we're all coming together to talk about how we're going to be supporting elders and where, and challenging one another around how do we put more supports in the home? How do we bridge services in community? How do we think about keeping people out of hospital, supporting people and not transitioning into long-term care? So we have 40,000 people waiting for long-term care in Ontario alone.
Wow.
Today.
Wow.
And with the shortages of our health human resources, this is a pivotal moment. And I think we will start to see even better discussions, because it's going to be to family members, friends, neighbors to step up and to support one another in a local community in the absence of the structural system supports, which aren't there.
Yep.
Notwithstanding the fact that we had decades to plan.
Yep.
We didn't. I don't think any government did. It is a moment of opportunity for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. As we've been talking about this for decades, folks like you and I that have been in this space, we have been screaming this, saying there's going to be a demographic shift. People are living longer and things are going to change and we're going to have needs. And we are really starting to see that. But as you said, there's glimmers of hope. The fact that you have a summit, the fact that you have more people, the fact that communities are starting to plan on more local levels and take action. These are little glimmers of positive actions and things that are happening.
As somebody who's worked in around government and public policy for decades, I always find that change is best driven from outside.
Yes.
If we start looking at people as individuals, but within the context of their communities, I think we really do have such an opportunity to demonstrate the type of leadership that we need and drive those changes. But our sense is with wait lists like we're seeing, it really will be more at the personal and community level where the changes are going to occur.
What I love the most about that is that it empowers people to make changes in the immediate. You don't wait for policy change. You don't wait until somebody dictates it. You get to drive the change. You get to do little things in your everyday that are actually like building the momentum for that change. And I think people need that. They need to feel I have some power and control here, that I can do something positive.
And this is where the movement begins.
Yes.
And it really has been such a delight to speak with you today, Tracy. And again, to our listeners, I highly recommend Tracy's book. It's very thoughtful. And even Tracy has me thinking about the title of our podcast. So, Coming of Age, Meeting the Needs of Our Aging Population. We can challenge ourselves. So Ageism Unmasked, Exploring Age Bias and How to End It. Let's end it. It's a great roadmap. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well.